You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
So in the past decade, if you had a subscription, most likely it would be a magazine or a local gym or a cable package. But nowadays, subscription is everywhere, from TV shows to music to food to clothes and anything and everything, a household item. Even a murder mystery is on a subscription. You can probably take it on a subscription, read it and again return it. So what's going on, Ronak, in terms of subscription? It's everywhere. So please throw some light on that.
Thank you, Tariq, and thank you, Joanne, for the generous introduction. And I'm glad to see that we are fellow Team Kendall fans. So good to know that. So yeah, so what we are seeing is, it's not something new. So subscription as an idea has been around as long as trade has existed, right? So it's, in fact, if you look at our day-to-day lives, it's basically the plumbing that is behind the walls, which you don't see very easily. So whenever a maid walks into a house, I mean, not right now, maybe before COVID, a maid would have walked into our house or even a newspaper would have been delivered to our home, or even a can of milk, or even the grocery store giving you your daily supplies or routine supplies regularly. That is also part of a subscription business which we have grown up with. So even the fees that we paid to the school and even most people who are employees, they essentially are subscribed by their organizations. The organizations pay our salaries, which is a subscription which they give us, give a monthly basis to us, and which run our lives. So it's pretty interesting that this concept is all encompassing. Like you said, it's everywhere around us, and it runs our day-to-day lives. And it has been so for, I think, centuries. I wouldn't say it's a very new concept.
Yeah, so before we get into the timeline of things, so I'd like the audience to put in the chat what are the kind of subscription you guys are subscribed to or already running. So you can probably use the chat box. Yes, Netflix, the usual. Amazon Prime, Netflix.
Like Jayant said earlier, like we, so as a business analyst and a financial analyst, you get an opportunity to study so many different kinds of business models. And some of these emerging business models which are based on subscription have come up off late. It's not like they haven't been around, but people are now innovating around the fringes to figure out how to take this to the most logical conclusion. And that war of dominance of platforms and everything we see around us is also part of that thing. So we may have opinions, we may have views, but by no means they are pronouncements or they are, by no means they are, like you said, gospel truth. These are just our observations and from our learnings, and we're trying to bring it out from the discussion.
Yeah, so most of their subscription in the chat is Amazon Prime, Netflix, Morning Context, newspapers. Yeah, there's an online book club subscription. Oh, shout out to that person who is doing that. He's having an awesome life. And of course, Audible, Discovery, YouTube. So Just Books, British Library. Nice. So these are some of the things which people are already used to. And of course, Ken, the web version of it. Bangalore-based firm. So yes, shout out to that subscription also. So these are some of the things which people are putting in. So before we deep dive into the topic, I want to share a slide on how the timeline of subscription has evolved. So it all started way back in 1500, map publishers. So basically, people used to drop the map and they used to lend it out on a subscription model wherein whoever is going on a voyage used to pay, subscribe to these things and take the help of the maps what they were drawn. Then we come to 17th or 18th century rather. Was that music concept as one of the thing was sold as a subscription thing where all the music lovers could go and subscribe to this. Then, of course, the famous telephone AT&T's in 1878. So at that point of time, the subscription was $1.5 per month, so equivalent to around $45 per month in today's inflation adjusted. Then came the TV channel consumer in terms of the audience subscribing to the TV channels. Then came the security companies, which is home security, which quite picked up in US post housing boom in late 90s. Then of course 2000 was demand video, wherein your Netflix of the world and its competitors started. Then of course the streaming online in 2000, then came Uber, Spotify, and then rest is history. So these are some of the things which how the timeline has evolved. We have come long way from 1500 to now in terms of subscribing to a map to now subscribing to everything.
So I think most of these businesses that we hear of, which are based on subscription, they are in a way designed in such a way to make sure that more and more number of people can benefit from the same resource. So for example, the example of the map makers that you give. So cartographers were very few in number, but people who wanted to go on expeditions, they were increasing day by day. And there was a need to get a constant update of what new information was being brought in by previous expeditions. So if you want to document that, a cartographer was the right person who would take the relevant information. You will then chart out on the map and then a new version would be released. And that information was relevant for a lot of people, not just for the sailors, but also for the people. So at that time, since there were colonial empires, the dominion of people was always there in terms of where do I draw my line in this map as compared to where some other country would draw their line. So these dominions were also divided. So my point was that if you want to distribute a resource across several people, more number of users can benefit from it. A subscription model where the incremental information can be provided and the product itself can keep changing. That concept, like from 1500s, is pretty amazing. I didn't know it was dated that long, but it's interesting to see that even then, even right now, for example, all the apps that we use on subscription or any software that we use on subscription, essentially, we don't buy a single product. We buy a right to use the product till we are a subscriber. And every single time we log into the product, we get the latest and the best version of the product, which is supposed to be running on that platform. So that's a unique advantage. So new features is basically a constant beta process. You keep on improving constantly. And as a user, you constantly keep benefiting from all the new features. Incidentally, in real life, that cannot be done all the time. I mean, you deliver milk every day, you cannot deliver new milk every day. I mean, improved milk every day. It's the same milk from the same tabela or the same milk vendor. It will keep every day. But yeah, it's interesting to see the genesis. And the reason why we are seeing a great explosion in this idea is because of the confluence of three things, which we all know. One is the internet connectivity. The business model was already there. You found internet to reach more number of people. And now you have found devices. So first there were computers and now there are mobile devices which can allow you to consume all these services. And essentially when we, for example, if you are a member of say the Swiggy Super, you're essentially on a subscription service which you have paid them an annual fee and they will give you all sorts of benefits for the physical transaction that happens between the app. So you may get a discount on fees, shipping fees, you may get a discount on the surcharge that they charge when there is greater demand. So all these things which you benefit from are part of that subscription. A person who is not subscribed to that particular plan will not be able to take advantage of these things. But what you're essentially doing is trying to create a connection between the physical world and a virtual world where you can transact seamlessly from one mobile device by the virtue of internet and a device in your hand and software being available to you. And the business model keeps running behind in the background. So essentially, more number of people benefiting from a small amount of resource. And of course, there's a shared element to it, which we can talk about later on. But I think the confluence of technologies has essentially accelerated the development of these subscription kind of business models, where as more number of people are getting used to the idea that, yeah, you can transact on the mobile device, you can transact with the UPI, or you can transact with the financial friction that has gone in between transactions, that has led to an acceleration of adoption of these services.
Yeah, the Internet of Things, which has only accelerated the progress of the subscription. So we'll get into the technology part a little later. So before that, to look into the kind of people who are using this. So I'll call it our generation. I wouldn't call it this generation because that would make us look so old. So our generation would like to have the milk, but do not own the cow. So where are we heading? Wherein we don't like owning any of this kind. What is so special about this generation in terms of renting out everything?
I think it's an interesting question. It's not aversion to ownership, I would say. People would love to own if it was a reasonable capital allocation that they are going to do. So for example, I'm just going a little bit on the financial side because a person may be in a different stage of life where they have enough capital to block on a certain asset. So if the asset prices keep going up, then it becomes very hard to think of owning something which is very expensive in terms of blocking a large chunk of capital. So that aside, if you look at the concept of ownership, it's essentially on-demand access. You want, so for example, if you own a car, you're not at the mercy of an app or a cab on the street to take you wherever you want to go at any odd time in the night or any time in the day. You're essentially going to get in your car, which presumably is working well, and you turn it on and you go wherever you want and you come back at whatever time you want without being answerable to any of the social constraints that you might have if you are using a third-party service. Having said that, the access part has improved so dramatically because now there is an incentive, there is a market-based system, there is a payment structure in place where a business model can exist that has caused incentives to have more people come on these platforms and provide access to more number of people. So sometimes you might find taxis going at very cheap rate on Uber. Sometimes you might find cabs available at very expensive rates on Uber. It's essentially a market-based pricing. It's telling you something that, okay, there is so much demand that it's a privilege that you got this car right now to travel in. And this access is provided to you at an extra fee. And what does that access give you is essentially the freedom to not own the car, not having the headache to maintain it, not having the headache to choose the right car, not having the headache to drive it yourself and get bogged down by the whole process of owning a car. But if you love to drive, I'm sure pretty much people would love to own that asset as well.
We'll get back to why the renting part has not kicked up in India, at least. Subscription model has disrupted the whole traditional model. So how do you see in what way it has disrupted in terms of the product, price, promotion, place? So the classic dynamics of product generation or promotion or doing it in a place. What kind of disruption is done in terms of how the traditional businesses were?
I think across all levels, right? So for example, I keep going back to the car because it's a very visible and a tangible example to take. Look at the number of cars on the Uber app. So essentially, these are standardized models which are sold, and these models will not have too many extra features, right? So what do you call the malai, the cream features which are there in any consumer car? So if you and I would buy a car, we would want comfortable seats, leather seats, good audio system, probably a screen in front, and all sorts of bells and whistles which a normal consumer might want in a basic car. Automatic transmission, everything that you can add up into a car till you can afford it. So all these features don't exist in these cars. So the extra cream that the car manufacturer would have made in terms of selling these cars or these models, which are anyway popular, that goes away. You basically are selling a standardized product at a standardized margin, and your bargaining power in that market as a car manufacturer goes away to some extent because most of your customers are going to be these people who are going to drive these cars and will probably not have the budgets to add any bells and whistles to their cars. And for example, if you are in the platform, you need to make sure that you're in the right tier of where your car is supposed to be to make the most amount of money to pay back your liabilities, which you are going to incur as a car driver. So all these things matter a lot in terms of the product creation, even marketing these products. So for example, if somebody, some company wants to market these products to say a platform like Uber or Ola, saying that, okay, you give us a bulk order, we'll probably give a discount to you. They'll take care of their volumes for them. So the asset utilization on their side is taken care of to some extent, but the overall profit margins that they could have earned by selling it to regular consumers goes away. But in a way, the same consumer is getting to use that car anyway, but at a much cheaper rate. That's a very interesting place where the car manufacturer may not control the entire ecosystem of how the vehicle gets used, but at the same time, they have to figure out the product price, promotion, and all these marketing concepts, which are letting them sell the car in the market.
Renting a car in Western world is quite famous. You've been to US, you drive across the country and things. Why do you why do you see, what is the problem with renting a car in India has not picked up as a subscription thing? We have very few business models and also very few choices when it comes to cars also in there. Why do you think this has not taken up in big way like the Western?
That's a fair question. So, I mean, renting is an old concept, right? People have been renting houses for as long as we know of apartments to be existing. But why not in cars? So essentially in India, it's not. We live in tiny cities. We don't live in cities where the connectivity needs to be across intercity. For example, the traffic between Mumbai and Pune would not have been that significant until the roads were developed and even people owning cars have developed, more taxis keep flying. Of course, there's an increment over a period of time. So if you take a 50-year period, you will see intercity traffic to be much greater. But within the city, the intra-city traffic, because cities are so dense and the roads network is not as good, driving has not been a very pleasurable activity. It's basically a utility activity. Most people enjoy driving only probably when they go on a weekend trip or they travel at odd hours when the roads are clear of traffic. So essentially, if you don't have driving as a pleasurable activity, the chances that you will learn how to drive and then probably rent a car to go from point A to point B on a regular basis goes away. And because there is no demand of that volume which is required to run a successful rental business. So as a person who will create a rental business, the most important thing is to provide access to people at different locations. So if you look at some of the companies like Hertz, which recently was in news, and even the other companies which are there, Enterprise in North America, which are more popular renting car renting companies, they have several locations within the city where they will have cars parked. And you can essentially go online, book a car, and they will tell you the location nearest to you where a car of your choice is being parked. And when you go there, you can easily unlock it with your smartphone, which is right now. Before that, you would have some person sitting in the garage who will be told that this key has to be given to so-and-so person, and they'll authenticate you with a ID card or something. So these things were available there because, again, the driving culture has been there, road infrastructure has been there. Most of these things are coming up now. So you can see clearly some new companies have been around in the past 8 to 10 years. You see some of the newer car rental companies coming up. But again, like you said, the choice is limited in terms of what cars you can get. Firstly, a lot of the cars, for example, many car manufacturers in India, their base models are quite cheap. So if somebody really wants to have their own car as an asset that they want to own and drive, they can actually go for a lower value car with less features. And they can have their own vehicle whenever they want to drive. They may not be utilizing it as much, but it will still be there. And for day-to-day commute, pre-COVID, they would definitely take advantage of public transport to reach their office destination or wherever. And a car will be like a utility vehicle where it is used either for irregular shopping or some other activity on the weekend which the family wants to take part in. Or some emergency drive that you have to go someplace where public transport may not take you. Now, just looking at this, imagine if you are a customer of one of these car rental companies and the place where the cars are parked is probably 20 kilometers from you. And at the time when you want it, you basically need to then book the car for a long period of time in order to anticipate some demand in your life. So for example, you have a smaller car, but you now require an SUV for carrying some guests with you to some location that you want to go. Then probably you can rent a car for one extra day, go there and pick it up, bring it back to your house. Park it there for a while, then you go and do your travel and then come back and then return the car again to the same place. So that is one thing where a little bit of friction exists still in that transaction. And again, like I said, because of dense cities and traffic issues and roads not being great, driving is not very pleasurable. So you don't want to get trapped in a traffic situation unnecessarily if you don't want to. Secondly, most of these companies who are renting, the reason why they have less number of vehicles is again a chicken and egg problem. So you generally want to have asset turnover, which is in a multiple greater than one. You don't want to have less than one asset turnover in terms of getting rental. And we'll come to this later because this is one of the most important factors in subscription kind of a business model where the asset utilization has to justify the business model in a way. So in order to keep your assets value intact, you have to also keep maintaining and cleaning the asset. So why would you want to keep the car around and maintain it more often than you're actually renting it out to people? So when it is out, it is actually used and the meter is on. You keep getting money out of the car being used. But if people are finding it less convenient to do it, maybe then there's a reason why their model has not flourished in India is because of the convenience, friction, as well as the ability to move around very easily within the city or intercity.
Okay. So there's always a joke in Bangalore when the Ola and Uber came in. The drivers always used to call and ask, "Kidhar aana hai bhaiya?" And we used to always tell, "You have to come to the address," and they would refuse. So it was joke was, we need to go to the car, we need to take an auto to reach the distance, but then get onto it. So yes, I mean, in terms of convenience, they are still trying to solve that. So, I mean, coming back to some of the most successful subscription where everywhere it's quoted and cliche to say is the Amazon Prime and Salesforce, how they pivoted and how they got the head start in terms of the subscription and thing. So, but I also want to know what kind of headwinds they faced in terms of when they were switching from their traditional model to the subscription, especially the Salesforce, and of course how Amazon pivoted using the whole ecosystem of Amazon Prime. And also I would like to know, it's very so nice to quote all the success stories. Tell about some of the ones who pivoted and failed miserably, and why did they fail?
So I think in software businesses, it's actually easy to start a subscription service because now it's very well accepted. But at a time when Salesforce was around, software was not consumed the way they were selling it. So essentially, software was like a box you buy and somebody will install and implement it on your system. Or if you're a larger enterprise, you're essentially relying on a contract manufacturer or a service provider like Infosys, TCS kind of companies who will essentially work with you and help the enterprise accept the software into their entire network. A company like Salesforce, I wouldn't say it's a very innovative business model, but at that time it was very innovative because nobody else of that type was doing it. So they are in the business of customer relationship management software. So you basically can manage your entire sales, end-to-end sales function, right from lead generation to conversion of that lead and then handing it over to the other team who will take care of the customer. So this process needed to be managed in a way where it could be scalable. So for example, if a company was small, you can have probably few sales people, like 5 to 10 sales people. And over a period of time, as your company keeps growing, and you realize that there are more avenues for selling your product, you need more salespeople, you need to reach out to more locations, and you become a distributed enterprise. You're not a single location enterprise anymore. So you will have one office in some other state, in some other city, and you have to coordinate all these sales things. So before you had something like a Salesforce, people would do it over Excel files or the internal ERP systems that the company might have. This is essentially an ERP system for the salespeople, I would say, just to give a bad analogy, but still it works in this case because we're trying to create a system where salespeople can coordinate all the lead generation, client satisfaction parameters very easily. At the same time, even provide customer support and feedback right into the app. So you know that every customer is mapped in the system, every customer's journey in the organization, how they've interacted is mapped in the system. And nowadays, these things are very common. I mean, we expect it. So every time you go on any website and complain for something or talk to a chatbot or whatever happens, whatever interaction you do with the service you're interacting with, they will send you an online ticket, which will have a unique number, and then somebody will reach out to you. So all these systems in the backend are controlled by something like a CRM software. Now, the interesting part here is, do you sell this based on the number of salespeople or do you sell this by number of transactions? Or do you create a system where you are able to get recurring revenue by not putting too much incremental effort in selling to the same customer? So for example, a system like a CRM software, I would presume is a very sticky system. It may not be replaceable like a mobile phone, for example. I mean, you can change iOS to Android in a whim if you feel like it. But over here, a system like a Salesforce, which is being used, cannot be switched very easily to a new system if you are displeased with it. So in a way, you need to also maintain your service standard of delivering that product, and the reason why the product was bought in the first place should be justified. And secondly, people who are using it should be able to benefit incrementally from that as well. So like I said earlier, all new features should be given to these people, but how will they give when the whole idea was to sell a box and the box was the version and you encourage people to upgrade to another version, which will then be replacing the older version. So in this case, a subscription model was the right way to go, where you essentially charge by the number of people or the seats, generally they call it, who are using that product. At the same time, for any incremental product requirements that the salespeople might have from the software, you can go by a different tier, where that tier will provide you additional customer support, which will help you achieve the same amount of outcome which you could have done, but in a much cheaper way. You don't have to buy or upgrade a new software. You essentially just upgrade to your next tier, and pay a subscription fee to essentially build all these things into the same system without spending any extra money on your end for creating another software layer on top of that. So these kind of conveniences are nowadays very easy to find, but at that time was very innovative. And that's the reason one of the earliest success stories in terms of CRM software were them. But they were not the only ones. There were other companies also competing with them. Some of them are still around, but they are part of some other organizations. So these, by acquisitions and consolidation, you will have a lot of companies going there. In fact, an Indian company, which I would like to recommend, we are customers of their company, it's Zoho. It's not some outstanding job, equivalent to, I would say, Salesforce, but at a tremendous value. And they are now branching into other services, which are again subscription-based services that they provide. So the idea behind Salesforce, although may not be new, but the implementation, the execution, and consistent delivery of that service quality, something I would say was commendable. And if you compare with people, a lot of people swear by Salesforce who are using Salesforce. But of course, people who don't use it do not miss it, right? I mean, they know that there is some other viable alternative available, which again, will have learned from the same success of Salesforce and other type of companies in that particular area. And they would have implemented the same features on their platform as well.
Yeah, the cost of switching comes in here. Why do I want to move into a new ecosystem when I have something which is already here? So talk about Amazon Prime. What have they done in terms of the whole ecosystem? And how are they holding that entire large chunk of subscribers? And how are they moving in terms of when they started, they didn't have, I mean, there were a lot of requests to Jeff Bezos. I mean, entire the senior management sent him out a mail. And most of the seniors even resigned for this idea. And Aman went ahead with the thing. And the rest is history, like they say. So tell us more about it.
So full disclosure, we own Amazon in the portfolio. This is not a recommendation. This is just a narrating of the history in a summarized format. I'm not going to go into too much depth. But the idea is, so Amazon Prime is, I think, one of the, I think, the ultimate subscribers package. You know, you cannot imagine anything like Amazon Prime. And the reason why I say it's the ultimate package, I think we will link up another book in the slides later. A book called Automatic Customer. And it's a fantastic book if you really want to learn about a subscription business and how to start one, or how to evaluate a subscription business from all the financial metrics as an investor or even the owner of that business. If you are trying to convert to a subscription business model, that book will actually give you a remarkable insight into various kinds of subscription models which are available. So in that book, I'm just going through the list because it's a 9-pointer list. Essentially, author, John Barilo, he talks about 9 different business models, which are essential subscription type of business models. And the differences may not be extremely stark. Some of them might be overlapping in terms of features. But the point of Amazon Prime I'm trying to make, and why I call it a super subscriber package, is because it encompasses all the 9 business elements into one single thing. So people are not familiar with the evolution of Amazon. They started off with selling books online. And at that time, it was a revolutionary concept, although buying and selling stuff online is not very new, but selling books online and the way they did it is basically not having to keep inventory in a bookstore. So if you go into a physical bookstore, you know what is stocked on the shelf and probably you know some amount of inventory is kept in the warehouse somewhere, which is nearby. But on Amazon, since it's online, you can put the entire library on the internet and essentially customer can buy something and then you can pick up that book from the warehouse, wherever it is located, and sell it or deliver it to the customer via courier service. So the same thing in which Flipkart was started in India, started all the books. So in a way, the time frame between Flipkart and Amazon is long, but in India, it took a long time to achieve the same innovation as in terms of selling books online. So the interesting part is from books, if you want to go to categories. So now if you go to Amazon and on the top left corner, if you click on the 3 bars, you will see all the categories of stuff that they sell on the platform. And clearly they have graduated from books to thousands of categories. Some of them are not even available in India, but if you go to Amazon.com, you will see even more categories that they sell online. The interesting part is, how do you keep customers coming back to your platform again and again? So what are the friction points for customers in transacting online? One is the cost of shipping. Nobody enjoys paying for shipping. At least I don't enjoy. If somebody enjoys, maybe, yeah, it's good.
But he must be owning a shipping stock, I suppose.
No, so nobody enjoys paying for shipping of your product. You just want to see the final amount on the screen, and that's the amount you want to pay. You don't want to pay additional charges extra. this problem was slightly pronounced in the US because that's where shipping costs are quite expensive. In India, you can probably send a small courier package of 30-40 bucks and you can still achieve the package going somewhere. But in the US, it can be as high as $30, $40 based on which service you use. So if you have a UPS or a FedEx kind of a exclusive service which sends you packages on time, they will charge more and the postal service might charge less. So right from building your own network of shipping to reduce the cost, which is what they did afterwards. But shipping was a huge friction. People did not want to, so people would abandon the car, products in the carts because shipping was too expensive for the particular product. They would rather go to a nearby store and waste time in searching the product over there. So whatever gains you had from convenience of creating the catalog were being lost because shipping was not frictionless. So Amazon Prime as a concept when it came, so at that time they did not have a Amazon Prime video service or Amazon Prime music service. The only idea was essentially to provide people a subscription service where they paid an annual fee and that fee enabled them to take free shipping on all products that they bought. And it was not preordained. Nobody knew that this is going to happen. But what they were starting to observe that people who subscribe to Amazon Prime, A, did not want to go on other platforms and search for the same product. So even if there were 10 e-commerce platforms competing with Amazon at that time, they wouldn't want to go because they are already locked in with a subscription. And you want to make the most of that because that is a slightly valuable subscription at that time when there was nothing else provided on top of it. Now you see a lot of things connected to it. Now you have a Amazon Prime video app, Amazon Music, you have Amazon Shipping, you have Alexa, you have all these things connected to your thing. You have a Kindle Unlimited account. You can do all sorts of things with the Amazon Prime subscription, which otherwise at that time you could not have done. That's again the beauty of the business model, right? You keep adding more value to the subscription where people essentially pay a little bit incrementally more. So for example, in India, it's actually irresponsible not to have an Amazon Prime subscription if you are an e-commerce shopper or whatever e-commerce platform you're using. So the kind of savings you get if you keep buying frivolous stuff online, you can actually save a lot of money by just not having to pay the shipping for these products. So at the same time, you get the benefit of participating in a closed network. And let me just walk you through, because what he did was very interesting. Now, when we look back, you now realize all these 9 patterns of businesses that Amazon follows. So for example, one kind of subscription model is essentially like Netflix, where it's like a all-you-can-eat buffet, right? So you go inside Apple Music, Spotify, you essentially pay a fee if you are a paid subscriber, and you get access to the entire library and you consume whatever you want, whenever you want. It doesn't matter to that service as long as you keep paying the monthly rental. So this is one way of creating an all-you-can-eat buffet service, which Amazon Prime has in terms of its music and video and books offering that they have. Second is it's like a membership website where you need to be a Prime member to benefit some of these things. So without creating that membership service in between where you can show a tangible benefit to all the users of that membership, you cannot use other aspects of Amazon.com. So you may be a person who browses on the website, but you may not be able to participate in some of the member benefits. So second model, which the book says is about membership benefits, which created implicitly by being a member of this service. Another thing is you get to be in front of the line of several sales. So for example, if you have a Prime Day, you might, because if there's a sale on Amazon, you as a Prime member, you get early access to all these deals. And then, for example, if a Diwali or a festival sale comes up, you sometimes get a couple of days advance notice in terms of participating some of these things. So an early warning, sorry, not an early warning, a front of the line kind of a business is also created in the subscription where subscriber can benefit from that. Another thing is you can also have consumables. So for example, as a Prime member, you can take advantage of subscribe and save feature on Amazon, where if you run out of soap every month, don't worry, we'll take care of it. You just pay for a subscription. You'll probably get a 5% discount, 10% discount on the overall price, but we'll deliver the soap to you. We'll deliver all the consumables to you whenever you need them. You choose the frequency. So if you think it expires, if you think you run out of soap every 2 months, fine, put 2 months. If you think you run out every 6 months, put 6 months. So they will take care of all these additional incremental consumption that you might have. So the interesting thing is to allow that, you need to have the system in place to begin with. So people might think at that time, okay, why would you want to do Prime? It's going to be so expensive. Shipping costs will go to the roof. We are going to take so much more on our P&L and not getting too much advantage. But if you see, the first step had to be taken and then you have to follow through. So the follow through happened quite consistently with Amazon by keeping the subscription service running, at the same time adding more benefits to the user. So another thing that they also do is provide a simplifying kind of an approach, where a simplified subscription model is basically, it simplifies your e-commerce transactions. You don't have to worry about anything beyond that point. You know that you're being taken care of by a service which never disappoints you. And they are known for the stellar customer support and stellar service in terms of delivery times and everything. So for example, if you're a Prime member, you get a chance to also participate in their offline stores, the physical stores. In India, they don't have physical stores. But in the US, they have Whole Foods, where you become, because you're a Prime member, you have different benefits you can take in the offline store. Because you're a Prime member, you can also access some of the new products which are going to launch on their platform. So in India, they have this different section on the website where some new startups who come up with products, those early access can also be done. So like a Kickstarter within this thing. So all these things can only be provided on top of this service, and you don't pay extra dime for that. At the same time, you keep enjoying global TV shows, movies, listen to worldwide music, and the same cost. I mean, it's like I said, it's irresponsible sometimes not to be a member of these kind of services. So imagine the layer of business models that they have disrupted, not disrupted, I would say, but enabled within their ecosystem. And no wonder people would want to spend more time on these platforms and spend more on the website. So I think a quote that Jeff Bezos uses is, when we produce more TV shows, people buy more shoes. So it's a fantastic analogy in terms of looking at how the flywheel of Amazon works because the Prime membership exists.
Cool. So that was about the success stories of Amazon and Salesforce. So tell us some of the big failures who pivoted and failed miserably.
So a lot of failures are very difficult to pinpoint. The reason is some of them might be natural outcomes of that business as well. So we cannot attribute it because of subscription failure. But one business that failed, again, for example, if you look at a book called Netflix, they compare their business, Netflix, with Blockbuster. Yes. Blockbuster was a much larger competitor of Netflix. And this is for people who are very young. Even I did not know this because I am also young as much as you are. So we wouldn't have known this, but Netflix used to deliver DVDs by mail. There was a DVD renting business of Netflix, which I was not aware of before I started studying Netflix. So the DVD rental business was much smaller as compared to Blockbuster and very tiny. And in fact, they even approached Blockbuster for an acquisition to take out Netflix because they realized it's running very difficult to compete with a national company like Blockbuster. But essentially, they pivoted. Netflix pivoted to the digital streaming model. And they use the same principles and learn some new things and realize that the world is moving to digital streaming. And they still have that DVD business, but it's very tiny as a fraction of the overall business. But Blockbuster retained that business model. They realized that, no, this is the physical business model, the physical store subscription is something that should be the business of the future as well. So what happens is a lot of times some of these businesses, they become niches. And then niche, if it becomes irrelevant, they will disappear. So we may be tempted to call it as a subscription failure, but it might be a failure of the business model and the adoption has gone to some other form of consumption. So the whole idea is a lot of reasons can be for failure. For example, a telecom provider in India, I won't name it, but
now that would take a genius to guess, I suppose. Yeah, please go.
Yeah, a telecom provider in India had a feature in between. I don't know if the plan still exists. So it was basically a exclusive plan, a subscription plan, which is specially designed to charge you more. And what they were saying that if we charge you more, we're going to give you these 10 different benefits on that. And some of the benefits were very interesting. So for the price that they were offering, they were giving you all sorts of things like subscriptions to Netflix, Amazon Prime. You named the OTT service and it was there in that package. They also provided you priority access to the network, which I found always very surprising. Here, you don't get bars on your phone and you're getting priority access to not getting bars on the phone. But at the same time, they were providing faster data package, free data, unlimited data, and all sorts of things were there. And the price point was, of course, when you see the price point, it feels ridiculously low. But if you look at the overall plan that you were paying before, it's like a 60-70% bump to the monthly rental that you're going to pay. Now you go back and we realize that, okay, this particular plan exists, but will it really help the business do well? Because all the other backend stuff has not been taken care of. So essentially, if the network is not working well, you cannot sell a slightly upgraded plan and tell people that this is going to be better than what we are providing to you right now. So that trust of the customer and the service quality that you provide needs to be matched. So this business is not yet failed. So I'm not going to pronounce it. But let's see, because a lot of things are in motion and we realize that these things, only in hindsight, they are very obvious and we can pinpoint, yeah, this particular aspect failed. But some of the subscription, because you are attuned now, subscription businesses, you can actually start seeing, okay, this subscription will work, this will not work. And based on your credit card statement, you can figure out, okay, what are the things that you are paying for on a monthly basis? And what are the things which are added in the recent few months, or what are the things which were already there? And now you have basically gone one tier up because you want to consume more of that service. So I think failures should not be considered to be binary. They might happen incidentally because the business model failed. But at the same time, relevance has to be there. So one thing I mentioned is the price and the service quality you provide. Second is the relevance. So people of our generation, I don't know if you subscribe to a physical newspaper. I don't. My parents do because they are old school and they enjoy making their hands a little black in the morning when they're opening the newspaper. I don't enjoy any ink on my hands in the morning. So I consume all my news on my phone and I would prefer to scroll than to turn a page. But the whole idea is that I subscribe to newspapers in a different way than they do. And they probably pay much less. Probably it's free for them because the extra paper that lies in the house, if you sell it by a kilo, you probably recover some of your cost of subscription, which is the business model for most of these companies. Yes. Advertising. So they're saying my parents are the product for the company and not the other way around. We are not buying a product. We are the product. The advertising is shown to us. So I prefer to go the other side where I go to the digital side where I become the product for a digital newspaper. And I consume the news media and I pay a monthly subscription for a variety of newspapers. So I get the content. It's not like I'm cutting off my content, but the way I consume it, basically the person, there's a supply chain that is providing the newspaper, right? So the person who will print the newspaper, provide the paper for that printing operation. Then at the same time, there's a distributor who will bring the paper to my doorstep. And then the recycle route where the paper goes back for recycling. So the entire supply chain becomes irrelevant, or the volume which was there in the past would reduce dramatically because nobody is now wanting to subscribe to a newspaper anymore. So the relevance of the product also goes, for example, if I move to a new place, so because I'm living in my hometown, all these existing subscriptions exist seamlessly right now because they have been used for the past several decades. Now, if I move to a new place, definitely I will cull all these basic subscriptions. I will start from scratch. And then they will have a reset of all my expectations of what things I want in my house at what point in time, what are more frequent, what are less frequent. So these things happen. So when people are also mobile, you will realize that some of the relevance of these products also go away. And lastly, I would say subscription fatigue, right? I mean, if you are subscribing to so many things, at one point as a customer, you realize that you're spending far too much of your monthly salary or monthly income that you're generating on subscribing several things because you started something on a whim and you realized you wanted to continue it, but you may not be using it that much. The most popular example is a gym membership, right? I mean,
yeah, people tell us about it.
subscribe to a gym membership. Okay, pre-COVID, I don't know how many honestly went to a gym regularly the way they wanted to commit to go to a gym. But yeah, most people don't go. And that's why
gyms... The first 15 days of Jan, there's a lot of rush with the membership people at gym.
The honeymoon period is essentially the 1 month of the offer which you have subscribed to. It might be a Valentine offer or a Diwali offer or whatever offer. You take that new for 1 month. You buy new gym clothes, but then they start looking old because you are still not out of shape. So you don't want to go there again. So the whole point is the relevance and the way you're consuming stuff always matters. And you eventually will cull all these things. The subscription fatigue will set in. You'll essentially decide, okay, these subscriptions are no longer relevant to me. But what I find more interesting is, and what I'm more interested in actually is what people retain. And that's where even Bezos says that, you know, a lot of things will remain the same and they are banking on things remaining the same. So he says that people will always want to pay less for whatever stuff they're buying. People will not want to get stuff delayed. They want the stuff as fast as they can get. And third is they want as much variety. So these things will always be universally same. And can you cater to that demand constantly? That is what most subscription services should aspire to become.
So like how you were saying about Blockbuster becoming a very niche. So there's one market that still beat Netflix hands down. So that is Alaska market, wherein Blockbuster still makes money in that one particular thing. So I think people are interested can check podcast known as Business War, which is Blockbuster versus Netflix. They deep dive from the history to the current situation. Interesting episode. So if people are interested, please do check that out. So coming to... in the subscription business model, innovation isn't creating new product or anything, which is basically tailoring certain services into customizing into the based on the needs of the customer. So can you throw in examples wherein, I know one top of my mind example is Salesforce, how they sort out their troubleshooting, which is overnight mailers, or they send in the people if something goes wrong. Tell us about how service is all getting customized or tailor-made to certain kind of customers based on their needs.
So over here, I would like to distinguish between business-to-business services and business-to-customer services. So B2C is something where customizations are far more valuable because people business-to-business customizations are far more valuable because then you're catering to the customer in a specific way, and that specific service that you've provided in that context is going to lock you in. So for example, consider a company like Oracle. So Oracle database software was extremely expensive, but you're subscribing to the maintenance of that database software and you expect that the customer support is there on the back end, because database service provider is extremely critical for many businesses to operate. So if you want a front end to run well, your back end has to connect to it perfectly and has to work seamlessly. So you cannot basically not pay that subscription and make sure that you stay always online because of that subscription provided to you. And then Oracle has to then maintain the service standards. But the problem with that is you sometimes get stuck with a bad product for a very long time. So there, after Oracle, there have been several new database companies around, and they are actually quite strong in terms of providing products as well. At the same time, because the grip of the service provided by Oracle and the fear of switching to a new platform and it may not work at the same way as the old one, that keeps people tied to a certain platform. So in B2B context, service providers and customizations are a little bit difficult to evaluate because they can be case to case. So for example, the Salesforce basic product might be the same, but what customizations they can buy on top of that in terms of the multi-tiered subscriptions that they provide, they can be totally different. The combinations can be totally different. So for example, if you're a B2C customer, for example, you go to a gym, the most customized service you can provide, you can buy is the gym trainer. So a gym trainer, essentially based on your needs and your goals that you're going to go to the gym for, they'll cater us a workout plan and a meal plan for you. So that is a more customized service that you get, and you can then evaluate the benefits of the service over a period of time and then decide to renew it or not to be on that same goal. In the same way, a salon, if there's a subscription service, they cater to your specific demands. Now, there are a lot of people. So, okay, we like the idea of having a customer come back to you again and again. And the whole idea of a subscription business is to avoid the need to search for any other service provider for that particular product. Now, how do you achieve this? And which is very weird, right? So for example, if you want to buy clothes, will you buy clothes on subscription? Which is something I always wonder. And there are so many businesses out there which are trying to do that, where they're trying to provide a wardrobe to you. And you know that your size is of a certain. So for example, I am in between sizes. So nothing ready-made fits me very comfortably. So I have to like find a specific brand whose size 32 is my size 32, and then it works very well for me. But at the same time, there are people who have standardized body types, and they can easily take advantage of these services where subscriptions can be created for them. And these products essentially can be dry cleaned and recycled. And which I have always wondered, why would somebody use clothes? But it's not something where people are really worried about. So I think Rent the Runway is an interesting company where they basically have all the trendiest designs available for you to rent. And it's like a box package you receive once every, few months or something like that. And you pay for it on an annualized basis. There's a subscription service for socks. So, I mean, a lot of these things, again, these are not supposed to be returned. You essentially keep the socks afterwards. But the point is that you keep getting these things frequently. There's a furniture rental service. I think it's Furlenco. So again, it can be provided to customize to your house needs. So they might have 10 options of furniture, but the sizes that you want, the combination of furniture that you want, you can pick and choose whatever you want and get a service customized for you. So I think customization and allowing the user to benefit from the entire range does benefit the subscription service, because they will retain the customer far longer, and then you will want to keep going back and saying, okay, what's new over here now? And if you retain that promise, if you maintain that promise, you'll always provide something new and updated, then I think the customer has no reason to go anywhere else, and you have a customer for life. And which is, I think, one of the most important concepts in subscription businesses is the lifetime value of customer. So we may, when we study businesses and we study the thing in the price product promotion thing you mentioned, the promotion bit always focuses on the customer acquisition, where the customer acquisition cost is something you pay once, then the customer gets used to the brand and you hope and pray that they will come back to you because they have the same need again. So for example, if you think Dairy Milk and chocolate, then they have done their job in terms of all the money they've spent in advertising that, okay, I know Dairy Milk. When I think chocolate, I think of Dairy Milk. And the brand association is so strong, you'll always go and buy the same chocolate. And the taste and everything, the legacy of the brand, everything will come back to you when you put the chocolate in your mouth. And you trust that brand because you don't know that any new chocolate brand you will try is going to be as good or is it hygienic. You don't know that. So the first barrier of people putting things in their mouth is solved because they have the association with the brand. So all the money that they have spent in customer acquisition cost has been benefited to them. But for a small business, I'm talking about large business now, but for a small business, a customer acquisition cost can be extremely expensive because you have to spend money on advertising and hope that a customer comes to you. And what if a customer doesn't come to you? What happens to that money? So in the situation like a subscription business, the customer is essentially, a lot of time people think it's the lifetime value of customer to a business, but essentially the customer is thinking from a different point of view. Customer is thinking from a lifetime value to the customer. Why am I subscribing to this business? So for example, if you subscribe to a magazine, there is a end time. Okay. For example, the time of a subscription ends because you have say 12 issues you're subscribed to. It's not like a forever subscription. A Netflix is a forever subscription. You don't have a expiry date on Netflix. And the magazine subscription, you have expiry date. Okay. After 1 year, you have to renew it and do some activity. That creates some extra friction for that. So the lifetime value of a customer for Netflix is actually far well defined. And they can essentially use all the accounting principles to make sure they make enough profits to generate and create new content to please all the customers across the entire network. But for a magazine or a newspaper, it becomes very hard. So I think a lot of these concepts of lifetime value of customer and customer acquisition cost, they don't gel together very well. And when businesses are thinking about themselves from a customer acquisition point of view, they in fact fail over here. Essentially, they're not able to pivot to that model very easily, where they can imagine spending more on marketing just to retain the customer longer. So the promotion bit always is a tricky one to figure out. And I think most businesses eventually figure it out. But by the time the cash flow runs out of their hands, then it's very difficult. Then you are in survival mode rather than thriving mode. So again, I come back to the book, The Automatic Customer, because it gives such amazing examples of how cash flows can change and how your business model can actually be working well. And you know that it's going to come to an end over a period of time. So for all the financial analysts listening to this right now, the terminal value of the business is known to you as an owner of that business. So now what do? Terminal value is known to you and is zero. Then do you really pivot and figure out a way to retain customers for longer? Then all your accounting expectations have to be changed. And you essentially are going to create a system where your cost will remain the same, perhaps, but your revenue will depend on all the new subscribers who are going to subscribe and stay with you as long as they feel your service is well relevant. So I think the promotion bit is a very important bit to figure out.
So it all depends upon how much consumer get his part of surplus to stay in the whole ecosystem. So,
exactly.
So that's about the innovation and the customizing of the tailor-made for the client. So let's talk about how subscription is making inroads to the for the investment world we come from. So throw us some of the disrupting ideas which is out there or someone is implementing. I know a couple of them. You please go first, then I'll tell you.
So more than disruption, I'm more interested in, like I said, what stays the same. So what is an investment? So for example, we run an asset management company. What is the goal of this company? The goal of this company is essentially to provide a reasonable return to all the investors who have invested. And we will basically take care of curating the portfolio of stocks which will deliver that return. And for that, all our investors are paying us a fee. Now, this fee is essentially a subscription that they are paying us on an annualized basis, saying that, okay, this we give it to you. You sort our investment needs. And as long as we are capable of doing that, generating a reasonable return as per their expectations, we will be hired again next year. That means the money will not be taken out of our fund by the investor. If the investor's goals are met, then they will take the money out and they will no longer be a subscriber to that particular service. So this is a very rudimentary way of looking at the investment business. What we are seeing is on the periphery, so many platforms are coming up and they are trying to create different versions. So, for example, we as an AMC might have one particular product in one particular style of investing, but there will be different styles of investing which people might benefit from. So, for example, we may not recommend people to invest less than 5 years in our portfolio, but some investment needs are less than 5 years. Then, where do people go for that? So, then you have all these variety of asset managers, and to curate that, curate those asset managers, you basically need people in different distribution roles or partner roles who will essentially create a list of portfolios for the clients based on their needs. And for that, the clients might choose to pay them a fee via paying the expense ratio of the regular plan, as they call it, or they can pay an upfront fee to some of the advisors. And that can be an annual subscription, essentially to maintain my portfolio allocation the way my needs are changing. And that, of course, involves a lot of customization. So to ping back to your point that you mentioned earlier, these are heavily customized services where the fund may not be customized, but the allocation of the fund in the client's portfolio of several funds that they might own to meet their goals, that needs to be customized in a meaningful way. I think that is seeing a lot of innovation right now, because where everything was paper-based and people were relying on the person, now people have an ability to go and research themselves, and they can probably ask questions to their advisors as to why this fund is good for me, why this fund is not good for me. The awareness of the metrics because of the marketing campaigns of mutual funds, and people are generally being aware of financial assets, that has actually improved. So now people are actually conversing about, okay, let me compare with the FD and its product returns over a period of time. How do I benefit if I earn 1% more extra return over a period of time? So this kind of communication is happening with the advisors. And I think advisors also are providing platforms for people to manage their own dashboards. So people can actually see what is happening with their investments. The account statements are far more dynamic now, instead of being a static piece of paper being printed out to you for some month. Although the need is the same, but as the clientele also evolves and their expectations also evolve, a lot of people are putting in the effort to present themselves better. There are also subscription services where on the lending side, so you might be a lender, so you can always invest in debt fund, but you can also join a membership like a club where you are allowed to lend to businesses at a very high interest rate. So these are definitely not meant for retail investors, but some people who are HNIs and are well averse to the risk parameters that they are in, they can actually do these high risk investments also by being part of this membership, a kind of a lending business, which otherwise a bank would have been doing on your behalf. And they will take the large chunk in between. But here the platform will essentially make it more democratic. So you can pull out whenever you want, you can go in whenever you want. So these kind of innovations are happening in the NBFC side as well.
Okay. So talking about the account statement, I mean, PPFAs is one of the firms who only put the IRR calculations in terms of the return percentage. No AMC does that, so shout out to that. So I know one or two innovation in terms of investment world. So like, you are aware of this club known as Tiger 21, which is the very exclusive club wherein assets under managed goes to almost around $20 billion of assets. And this buying into this club is $30,000 per annual subscription. And every month wherein everyone has to go there and present their best ideas, and they will be evaluated both good and bad. And based on the curation, everyone takes a decision left to them whether that suits the purpose. That's one exclusive club which I know wherein people make investment decision based on this exclusive club. The other side of the handling of the investment per se, there's a little bit disruption in terms of the online and all, how the traditional model is moving away from the percentage on assets managed. It's going into more of a monthly certain amount is charged and you go do your implementation anywhere in terms of the investment. So those are one or two subscription types of business which are very fast growing because thanks to Internet of Things and apps wherein access to investments has become much more paperless and easier to do. So these are one or two things which are there in terms of evolving in there. So a couple of shout outs so plugging in, of course, we have a pod known as Book of Sins, wherein people can listen to the the new Harshad Mehta thing which is happening. We have done recording on that if you're interested. And Ronak and team runs a monthly financial opportunities which is available on their YouTube channel PPFS, wherein they deep dive into new topics every month. So that's a very interesting YouTube channel wherein you can subscribe and go into. So that's with the recommendation. So for that, thanks Ronak for doing this. And a couple of shout outs, I would be remiss if I don't thank Tariq, of course, who's handling the tech behind, and one particular gentleman, Navin Fernandez, who helps us with the promotion. Then, of course, shout out to PPFA's Twitter handle, Masterless Twitter handle, and Invest Books, who have promoted our event. And, of course, my studio here, Hindumati Bhavan, I'd like to thank.
With that, this is Tariq signing off. Thank you again, Ronak.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you, Jayant.
Yeah, thanks guys for supporting us. Keep coming back.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.